You're listening to 91.9 FM, WUMB FM Boston, WBPR Worcester, and WFPB FM Falmouth. At 91.7 FM, WNEF Newburyport, WUMT Marshfield, and WUMG Stowe. And live on the web at WUMB.org.
Club 47 in Cambridge is well known for the important role it played as an engine of the 1960s folk revival and the development of folk rock, a genre that would come to dominate the musical landscape. Bob Dylan performed there, as did the Love and Spoonful, Taj Mahal, Joni Mitchell, and many others. The club is the subject of a new documentary titled For the Love of the Music, The Club 47 Folk Revival. The film is narrated by actor Peter Coyote. It features new interviews with musicians, previously unreleased music, and newly filmed performances with folk music's current, rising, or established stars. For the Love of the Music premieres at the Boston International Film Festival on April 17th. Today on Commonwealth Journal, we'll be talking with director-producer Rob Stegman and Club 47 program director Betsy Siggins about loving the music and documenting the folk. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for tuning in to Commonwealth Journal. We're delighted to have with us today filmmaker Rob Stegman, director and producer of a new documentary about Cambridge's Club 47, a key performance venue for the 1960s folk revival. We're also joined by Club 47 program director Betsy Siggins. Thank you both for coming in. All right, I'd like to start at the very beginning, since in this case there is one. What's the origin story of Club 47?
It was begun by two graduate students from Brandeis University who thought a French coffee house with jazz would be a nice idea for Cambridge. And they found a building in the hinterlands, as it was once known, of the proper Harvard Square, and they opened a little jazz club. I think they were really just in the beginning stages of it when, rumor has it, Joan Baez was encouraged to walk in and ask if there was an evening where she might play. And they thought, well, that's a funny idea. We don't know anything about folk music. But hey, what the heck? Let's let her sing. Well, that was their first and last mistake, because she opened her mouth and it was golden. And they said, absolutely. So she played on Tuesday nights for $10 a night for a long time. And that instantly kind of drew other students, particularly who were interested in the folk music community, and it certainly was becoming more popular on other campuses across America. And Cambridge seemed like a natural home for a folk music community. I don't know how everybody else got there. It feels like suddenly everybody was there and everybody had their own night. And we were such great business people. We charged $1 for the membership. I don't know what we were thinking. It was so much money. And then it was, I think, 50 cents to get in and $1 for a membership. You can see how the economics of that wouldn't hold up too very long. But fortunately, through the lack of business planning, there was a rise and a love of the music and the people who met each other and the families who then became families and babysitting afternoons. And we filled the club up with as many activities as we could, which have continued on, like a public community art gallery. We used to do brunches on Sunday and supply the New York Times. Every moment was filled. And so very few of us wanted to have any other jobs or continue in their education, though some did. So that's kind of my memory of how we got started.
I think one of the interesting things about the club is that it actually started as a coffee house and was only after they put music in and then were shut down by the Cambridge police. It was closed, and, you know, I think the culture of Cambridge, and you can read into that whatever you want, but the culture of Cambridge didn't really want these hippies in their jazz coffee house, so they shut it down. And so that's where it became this nonprofit, where they were charging people $1 to join the club. And that's kind of how it turned into this nonprofit that has essentially been going on since 1958.
And what brought you to make a movie about it? Why did this seem like the right time?
Well, that's a very good question. It being the right time actually came from an association with Betsy's organization, the New England Folk Music Archives, I think was really what made it the time. I came to the movie through my production partner. We were roommates at Boston University in the late 70s. And, you know, we're good friends. And then he made a prior movie about jug band music called Chase and Gus's Ghost. And so that's how he got connected to the folk world, to the folk community, through Jim Queskin and Jeff Moldo, who are, of course, good friends of Betsy's and part of that scene. And he then came to me and said, do you want to work on this project with me? And I love folk music and like music and, of course, love filmmaking. And so that's how I came to it.
Can we back up and talk about the music a little bit? We're saying folk music, but that has meant different things in different contexts. So was folk music during this moment, the heyday of Club 47?
At Harvard University, back in the I don't know whens, they had the collection of child ballads. And I believe Child was a professor at Harvard, and he brought an enormously important collection of early English, Irish, Scottish music with him, and it's all annotated in what Wagner Library. And so that was kind of a pivotal touchstone for people who didn't know where to go or what to hear, were perplexed by what folk music was. But that was a clear indication of some form of balladry that is a very important part of folk music today. In the very early days, the talent was pretty much local. Then it sort of began to blossom when people like Ralph Rinsler and Alan Lomax, who followed his father John, into the South with a tape recorder on their back, really knocking on doors and asking if there was music being played in various places. And of course, that collection now is online, and it is a magnificent testament to the real importance of folk music. I mean, people say all the time, well, yeah, but what is it? Well, it's people's music, and it's for people. It's everyday music, and it's startlingly, wonderfully new, experimental, built on old roots and traditional music. I think the scene today is as exciting as when I was 18, and just discovering through different people different kinds of traditional, rootsy, Americana, British, all kinds of music that was sort of presented by artists who were just beginning, and they found a niche for themselves. Tom Rush was one of the earliest songwriters, but he started out doing Eric Von Schmidt music, some old blues music. So this is kind of the way all of this was born. You locked into something that you either liked to listen to or you liked to sing, and then you found like-minded people.
So one of the fascinating things, as Betsy is saying, I think about this decade that we're talking about in the movie, from 1958 when the club opened and Joan Baez walked in, to 1968 when it closed, is it really traces that evolution of what we now understand as folk music. It started off with Joan as the child ballads. Blues were introduced, the southern music, then bluegrass, big bluegrass scene. And that evolved, as we saw, through people like Bob Dylan as they came through, or Eric Von Schmidt, and then Tom Rush, to be the singer-songwriter tradition that we may think now as folk music. So people like Ellis Paul, who's in the movie, or some great contemporary artists like Anja Duvakot. We really see in that decade the history of what we now understand as folk music.
And why were these young people, young musicians, young audiences, why did they decide to look back in time for musical inspiration in 1958?
I think that was the birthplace of the traditions. And we didn't have, we had the Weavers, we had the Everly Brothers, but we didn't have a roadmap going forward. So it sort of became part and part of what we did was sort of creating a new roadmap from the old roadmap. People always say, well, what is folk music? And the scholars can spend their time on that. But what we found was a gorgeous home. And it gave many, many, many of us the roadmap to our lives.
And how did Club 47 connect itself to the civil rights movement? Speaking of the roadmap to the future.
You talk about it being part and parcel of the time. Club 47 was the home where you all gathered to discuss the Vietnam War, civil rights, women's rights, everything that was going on in the time period. It was a natural place. It was a physical place where you could come together and deal with those issues mm-hmm. and how it filtered through the music.
I mean, Phil Oakes would come through the club often, and he was certainly one of the foremost leaders of the anti-war movement. Joan was marching at some point sooner than later, marching in Selma with Martin Luther King. I think many, many people had their eyes opened to the world in a way that was tolerable, that was a way in, that didn't cost you a lot of money. You know, I like to compare it to a college education in its own right, because I would not be sitting here today had I not gone through the early days and then come out as somebody who just found home and found a niche for myself that I feel is, you know, relatively important to keep the words going and to keep musicians inspired and to nurture people who are young. And it's in my dotage. It's become something of great pleasure to me.
Well, you know, it's funny, I've been referring to Club 47 as a performance venue, but listening to you speak, it sounds to me that it very quickly became more than that, and it became a community.
Absolutely.
I think what we tried to show in this film, and I think this was really unique to the Club 47 situation, is it really was people getting together for the love of the music and for the love of each other, you know, nurturing each other. You know, we talk about, you know, what was unique about Cambridge. It wasn't a nightclub where you came to listen to someone play. It was a shared experience. You know, you get up on stage and play, you go back and sit in the audience. It was a place to gather, to explore music and politics and everything that was the early 60s. I think we have, you know, the story, you know, you asked about civil rights. One of the stories that came out of this that has ripples today was Jackie Washington's arrest in 1962, what we would call today a walking while black arrest. It certainly has repercussions, or reflections today. And I think it, as Betsy described, it brought the civil rights struggle right into the club.
And I think we felt there was a safety in numbers. Had each of us not had that place to brainstorm ideas, I think we wouldn't have been open to as much of the troubles that were going on. Someone said to me, who's a younger folk singer, who wants to hear about the 60s anymore? Aren't we tired of talking about them? Well, I'm not. and I think that we're almost on a third revival. It's a whole new playing field now for artists who've taken bits from every kind of music we have to offer and put them into another format. I think of the kids who are playing string bands now and old-timey music, but with new twists on it. It's just exploding.
Rob, what was it like to gather these people together to make the movie?
It was the whole experience was fascinating for me. I'm obviously a bit younger. Not obviously because we're on radio. I'm younger than this group. I missed the tumultuous 60s. I'm a 70s generation kid. For me, it was fascinating both as history and as a contemporary story, because I don't think you can think of the 60s without seeing how it's reflected in everything we're doing today. The arguments that were, you know, the ridiculous arguments that we're still having, but musically. You know, you got younger artists now doing a whole album covering Dylan songs, or the Woody Guthrie centennial and everyone doing that. There is the same process of reflecting on the old music and making it something new. That's been a delight for me. I was more singer-songwriter oriented. The musicians of my youth were Tom Rush, but also James Taylor and Joni Mitchell and that generation. To one of the great discoveries for me on this was meeting and learning of the music of Jeff Muldaur. I didn't know anything about him. And hearing him perform and meeting him was really a memory that I'll always have. You know, it was great talking to Taj Mahal. It was terrific talking to Joan Baez. Judy Collins. I mean, it was really nice for me to meet and talk to those people. But I feel like the people I've developed a relationship with, Betsy being one, Jeff, Tom Rush, that's been really meaningful because of what they have brought from their experiences through to today.
And who was missing? I mean, this is sad to talk about, but what figure really mattered at the time who isn't around anymore to reflect on it?
Obviously, the biggest loss was Eric von Schmidt.
Dave Van Ronk. Really, the list is fairly long. Bill Monroe. Bill certainly lived a long life, but he's missed.
Of course,
he's
yes.
Missed as a leader and a player. And
it's one reason why it seems really important to make the movie, right? So you can, you know, document these voices while they're still there to be documented.
It was a fascinating experience from that standpoint. I mean, Eric von Schmidt is actually another one I knew nothing about until starting this process. And that's somebody I would have liked to have spoken to. I mean, what Betsy has said about him and what others have said, and obviously the influence of his music on Bob Dylan and on everybody was remarkable. So that's somebody, as a filmmaker, really a significant person I would have loved to have delved into.
Well, Betsy, you were around for the whole story, but Rob, were there any surprises for you?
You know, I didn't know much about the, you know, I knew about Passim. I didn't know of Club 47 until starting this process. So kind of all of it was a discovery for me.
A revelation.
It was all a revelation. And, you know, the Joan Baez story and, she's had her movie about her. But sitting in a room and having her tell the story, having Betsy, who was good friends with Joan, another Boston University connection, in fact, or talking to Deb Green, you know, who had somewhat of a different take on it. Every interview and bit of research and crafting the story was a discovery.
If you're just tuning in, we're joined today on Commonwealth Journal by Rob Stegman, director of a new documentary film about Cambridge's Club 47 and the folk revival of the 1960s. We're also talking to one of the club's mainstays, Betsy Siggins. What are the real gems? I mean, if I can get you to say a little bit ahead of time, which unreleased recordings are fans going to be the most thrilled about?
I think it depends on your bent. If you're a Joan Baez fan, the fact that we have this recording, we think from 1960 maybe or 59, very early on, that's from the New England Folk Music Archive collection. You know, if you're interested in Joan Baez, I mean, that's it. To see her picture, 17 years old, 18 years old, and that voice, that's the beginning. If you are a Bob Dylan fan, hearing him playing harmonica and singing along with Eric von Schmidt you remember the event. It was just calling Bob up on stage. It was basically what the club was.
Yeah, when Eric would say, "Does anybody want to come up and sing?" he knew who he meant.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Did he say, "I'm looking at you"?
Well, he had a very persuasive way about him. And he was on stage, he was a good time Charlie. I mean, he was playing to have fun. But he had friends that were part of his sort of family. And they often came up. I mean, we used to have a hootenanny every Sunday night. And Bob Jones, who ran the hootenannies, would often start out with, five or six 23-verse ballads, really warming us up. And then the night became sort of a musical free-for-all. But, I remember it clearly. I love Bob for his drollness and his ability to remember 23 verses. I mean...
I think you described that as being, you know, sitting through a literature class. You know, when's the test going to be?
Oh, yeah. Yes. We could have been graded.
Yeah. And so that kind of nature, I mean, when I listen to these recordings, you know, knowing Bob Dylan as a historical figure, he got up on stage with Eric and that recording that we have. Eric barely knew who Bob Dylan was. You know, Bob didn't know who Bob Dylan was. It's one of those moments where
he was barely Bob Dylan.
He was barely Bob Dylan. Exactly. And so that's one of those, it's a glimpse of history that I think is one of the great things about filmmaking.
One of the things that seems fascinating to me just listening to the two of you talk is the breakdown of this dividing line between audience and performer, which is usually so strictly enforced in our music listening practice.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. A lot of opportunities get missed when you're not open to conversing musically with other people. But that's why In the Rounds are really a wonderful thing, when musicians who don't necessarily know each other or each other's music get to share in a circle. And much is learned from that, and people make real friendships from very diverse points of musical loves. I don't want to not mention the richness of bringing the black musicians up from the South. It was segregation. They could not rent a hotel room. They could not buy clothing in clothing stores in Harvard Square. However, the beauty of that for us, very selfishly, was that they get to sleep on our living room couch. I mean, the memory of Reverend Gary Davis in his overcoat and an old battered up cardboard guitar case, sitting on the couch, drinking some kind of booze, but kids spilling over from Club 47 to come and do the all-night hangout, and then him never taking off his coat and falling asleep on the couch. I mean, there's nothing like those experiences. I'm sure there are somewhere, but it's not in our lexicon anymore. And through people like the Newport Folk Festival, they had the wherewithal to go south and rediscover or discover these guys who were in their 60s, 70s, and at some point their 80s, who had never been north, who basically were either church or street corner singers. And bringing them north was quite an experience for them. But for us to be 18, 19, and 20 and listening to that music so intimately and so close to us changed our lives forever. And you know, I look at the Queskin Jug Band, who brought back real old-fashioned jug band music, and then I look at the North Carolina Chocolate Drops, who are bringing back, you know, street music. And there are so many similarities now of people reaching back, and the stuff is still there for them, which is what's important about the archives, is that we're trying to make it there for everyone. Not everyone will get into the Library of Congress, but there's a place for people who've made their livelihoods, such as it has been, as a musician in a field that doesn't bring billions of bucks.
And what brought you to Peter Coyote to narrate this?
Well, I knew Peter back in the early days when he was one of the most outrageous people in the area, and then he became the Diggers, and they went to California and started Haight-Ashbury. But I'd known him from here and from Martha's Vineyard. And so for me, it was an email to Peter saying, I have an idea for you. How would you like to narrate this film? And he said, sure.
And that was another great experience for me, not only because obviously he's a tremendously talented narrator, but he had his own personal connection to this story. I mean, you know, it of course doesn't make the movie, but you know, around the voiceover session, he was talking about hanging with Jeff Moldauer and Jim Queskin on Martha's Vineyard, and we were blessed that we you know, did some picking parties around this movie, and Peter came to our Berkeley picking party and leads one of the songs, and it's a side of Peter that you don't get to see if you only know him as an actor or as a terrific narrator that he is. So seeing him sing Stagger Lee, terrific. One of those moments. One of those moments.
But see, as you said, Peter Coyote became very associated with California. And then in New York, there was the Bleecker Street scene. Were there regional particularities to the Club 47 scene that distinguished itself from those other locations?
Well, we weren't New York. I think that's always been clear. And there are a million opinions about the difference between the Boston scene and the New York scene. Other college campuses, other than the New York scene, had formed folk music clubs. And that's how I met Ralph Rinsler. He was at Swarthmore, and he was born to be a folklorist in some fashion. I think the New York scene was more political. I think born in Greenwich Village in Washington Square was a real political movement against the war. I think at Harvard and the communities around Boston were not as zeroed in on the war, but became more aware and more so through the music and the musical scene.
When you look back over Club 47's heyday, what are you the proudest of?
The multi-universe that made up folk music.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that. To me, what was the challenge in telling this tale is how do you do justice in the amount of time that we had to all of these different influences, the ballads, the blues, bluegrass. You know, there's a whole side story about the hillbilly ranch and bluegrass that we could only allude to. The anti-war movement, the singer-songwriter, you know, as Dylan started writing and then others went, hey, wait. We can write too, you know, and it really is that moment in time. It really is remarkable when you think about how all these talented people showed up together, reinforced each other, and you know, improved their skills, their sensibilities, learned this, learned that, and really transformed music into something new. You know, not only Cambridge. Obviously, it was happening in other places. But it really, to me, you know, it's a little trite looking back to call that period of time a Camelot time, but it really was a magical moment where a critical mass was reached. And it was different than New York. Greenwich Village was a commercial scene. Those clubs were there to, you know, you show up in the club, then you go up the street and you record at Columbia. You know, people recorded in Cambridge, but that wasn't why they were in the club. You know, I think that made it, gave it enough of a different sensibility. John Cook told had a line, which unfortunately did not make the movie, where he said, you know, the one difference between Cambridge and New York is that in New York, you turn your back to the audience when you're playing your best licks. And in Cambridge, you were right out there playing it, so...
A direct descendant of the clubs still operates, Club Passine, still in Harvard Square in Cambridge. How is the lineage still visible, or I guess I should say still audible?
Well, I think they have, they've amassed a very important group of younger singers who many will probably do well. I think Matt has a great sense of that generation and does really amazing booking. I think they're less involved with the older artists now, but that's how things change. So I think they do a good job at that.
It is interesting because obviously of my age, Passim is what I knew. And I think that Passim has ebbed and flowed, over time. They obviously feature, you know, up-and-coming emerging artists or some younger artists, although I will say that I'm actually pleased that Jeff Moldaur is going to be playing there in April. Maybe they're beginning to get some of the old...
Duffers.
I think they're beginning to get the 47 sentiment of, we can learn something from the older performers. What's interesting to me about the Club 47 performers is they are now...
The older performers.
Exactly. And they are carrying that tradition forward in a really interesting way. It's that lineage that really we are able to see. And so now Jeff or the Charles River Valley boys that still play together occasionally or Jim Queskin when he's out or Tom Rush, obviously.
Judy Collins.
They are the grand masters that Reverend Gary Davis was or Bill Monroe was in those days. So,
where can people see the film?
The only place to see the film right now is going to be its premiere at the Boston International Film Festival. It's premiering on April 17th, which is a Tuesday night at 6 p.m. at the AMC Lowe's Common Theater, which is the big movie theater right on Boston Common. And I have to say, we are so thrilled to be having our premiere at this festival because obviously it's a big Boston story.
Commonwealth Journal is a weekly production of WUMB-FM Radio at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Support has been provided by UMass Boston, a research university with a student-centered education. Our engineers are Dave Palmatier and Grady Motes. Our executive producer is Patricia Monteith. You can reach us at 617-287-6917 or on the web at commonwealthjournal.org. For Commonwealth Journal, I'm your host, Rachel Rubin, Chair of the American Studies Department at UMass Boston. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for Commonwealth Journal.
You're listening to WUMB, a community service of UMass Boston. Earth, sky,